Welcome to episode 10 of the Pianofortissimo podcast. I'm Alexandra Siloccia, and I couldn't think of a better way to celebrate this little milestone than by inviting my wonderful friend, the incredible bass singer, Matthew Rose. I'm especially delighted not only because it's an honor to have him here, but also because Matthew is a wonderful friend I've had the pleasure of knowing for the past 10 years or so. And I also had the joy of performing my very first Winterreise by Schubert with him. Matthew Rose studied at the Curtis Institute of Music before becoming a member of the Young Artist Program at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden. His international career has seen him enjoy a close relationship with the Metropolitan Opera, for whom he gave his 100th performance in 2022. The season 2024-25 includes returning to the role of Fasolt in Das Rheingold for the Bayerische Staatsoper and performances of Rocco in Fidelio with the Opera Nationale de Bordeaux. On the concert platform, Matthew sings Bruckner's Mass No. 3 with the SVR Symphony Orchestra, Mussorgsky's Songs and Dances of Death with the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and returns to Winterreise in performances across the United Kingdom. Matthew is not only an extraordinary performer, but also an enthusiastic and dedicated teacher. His newest project, Folkestone on Song, is a wonderful initiative aimed at bringing song and singing to Folkestone and East Kent. You'll find more information about this in the description below. I now invite you to join us for a relaxed conversation over breakfast at my place, where you might occasionally hear the sound of a biscuit being enjoyed. Welcome to Pianofortissimo, the podcast where the world of classical music meets personal stories and professional insights. I'm your host, Alexandra Siloccia, concert pianist and Bösendorfer artist for over two decades. Join me as we explore the intricacies of music careers, the artistry behind pianos and other instruments, dive deep with special guests from all corners of the arts, and uncover the nuances of cultural and self-management. Whether you're an aspiring musician, a performer, or simply a music lover, this podcast offers something for everyone. Good morning, Matthew. I'm thrilled to have you here with us.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for making me breakfast. That was nice.
For our listeners, it's 8 a.m., sort of.
It should have been 8 a.m.
It should have been, but we're here. How are you today?
Good. It's great to be here. And I get to see you, and I saw your little son walking to school, so that was nice.
We don't have much time. You have to catch a plane. I have to teach. So we have 30 minutes of speedy questions.
Okay.
So awesome. Let's start. Matthew, many performers struggle with performance anxiety. How do you manage nerves, particularly when facing high-pressure performances like premieres or when you're performing in renowned venues?
That's a very good question, isn't it? So opera is slightly different from anything else in that sometimes when... I mean, I get the most stressed and the most pressure when I'm doing something for the first time. So I find the hardest thing for me is the learning of the music and getting it into my head and getting it into my body and then getting it from my body out of me onto the stage. Actually, at the moment, we're doing a new opera in Munich. We're doing the Rheingold, and we've had 7 weeks to rehearse it. So you have 7 weeks to be around your colleagues, to be there, to be in the situation. So I never feel nervous or anything because you have this amazingly long process doing something. I mean, if you're doing a recital for the first time and you know, if playing the piano and you're doing a two-hour recital or something and you never get a chance to spend 6 weeks with these people doing it, you know, it's a completely different use of time and a completely different process. And this process makes it very comfortable for us to do our job well, and therefore not to feel nerves, and actually we just feel excitement when we're doing it for people, you know, because we're doing this job because we love this music and we love what we're doing and we want to show it in our best ways to people. I mean, the most nervous I ever feel actually is the first day at work and you're singing for your colleagues for the first time.
Yeah, and that's
that's the most, but at the same time it doesn't matter, does it? Because it's just a first day at school, or singing, you know, when, if you go to the Met and you sing for the Met chorus, because I have such respect for these people, and it's, you know, they're all much better singers than I am probably, and you go to the Met and you have to sing in front of this group of 80 people, brilliant 80 people, that's, I feel very nervous in front of them. Standing on stage in front of an audience, I just love sharing this amazing music with people. So unless it's something I don't know very well or I struggle with technically, then I feel very comfortable to be there and happy to share with people. Is that a good summation of the situation?
Of course. As a singer, your voice carries immense power. What is your routine for maintaining vocal health, especially during periods of intense performance schedules?
Another good question. So luckily, again, just the way operas are normally scheduled, you have time between performances to recover. I mean, it is a very physically demanding thing we're doing. And, you know, the vocal folds and the vocal muscles are some of the more fragile muscles in the body. And if you're doing a long, you know, if I say I'm doing Rosenkavalier, I'm singing for 3 hours on stage, and, you know, it's a very demanding thing on my little vocal cords. So they need a couple of days just to recover. And then once you've recovered, you can hopefully rebuild for the next performance. So, but just generally, I mean, I was incredibly lucky to have a wonderful teacher. I went and studied in America at the Curtis Institute, and I had an amazing teacher I used to go up to see in New York every week, Marlena Malice, and she really helped me understand that if I was to use my body correctly, not just the area where the vocal cords are and where sound is technically produced, but to use your whole body to make sound, to access the lower abdominal muscles, which are underneath some of our bellies. excuse me. But so if you activate those muscles, you allow your whole body to make sound rather than just compressing the sound from your throat. So I've been very fortunate in that I've been given a very good grounding in how to make a very healthy, easy sound, I think. And that's something that I like to pass on to people with my teaching and stuff.
So is this a routine you're every day doing, is this something else already internally there?
I had 5 years of lessons with her every week, and I mean it was I did really well with that for about 15 years of my career, and then suddenly I don't do it as well as I used to for whatever reason, but I can still access it if I just need to think about it a bit more than I used to. It used to be a very natural thing. I just breathed in and these muscles activated and then my whole body was ready to make sound, you know. It's, you know, the way a baby cries, you know, when you hear babies crying, it's because they access those lower abdominal muscles because they're on 4 feet. You know, when we stood up and we're just on 2 feet, we lost the ability to get into there to make very easy sound. Babies make that amazingly easy sound because they're on 4 feet, or they've not even learned how to get on their 4 feet or 4 pods, whatever. And they can access that, and therefore the whole, from that area all the way up through your chest and everything is available to resonate and make sound. You know, and just understanding and accessing that is such an important thing for singers to do. And the really great singers do that. And unfortunately, it's something that isn't really talked about enough, maybe in conservatories and with teachers nowadays. So, you know, it's amazing. I meet so many people who come to me and I have to sort of explain this to them. And it's not, you know, it's not brain surgery. It's something all great singers have done in the past. So there we go. Does that make sense, all you piano people out there that are listening? Because Alex is a wonderful pianist, and you're
totally interested.
No, but it's the same with you. I mean, when you want to make a great sound, you don't just use your fingers to make sound. Absolutely. You use your whole body to make sound. It's just like, whoops, sorry, that was breakfast. It's the same with us. If we really activate our whole bodies to make sound, then you're going to make a much more beautiful, efficient, in tune sound. You know, it's just naturally how the body is made to work.
But is there something in particular you're doing, like the next day after the performance, just to, you know, recover, build it up, and?
Yeah, I mean, sleep is the great cure for all these things. I mean, after a performance, sometimes, I mean, not me necessarily, but a lot of people have such adrenaline flowing through their bodies, they find it hard to sleep the night after a performance. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you just want to take it easy. And the day of a performance, if I'm doing something long like Baronox or something, I don't do anything. I don't speak to anyone. I just sit around. I'd have a little walk maybe. But, you know, you just have to hold your whole, all your energy for, I mean, it's a brain thing as well. I mean, it's getting your brain, you know, when you're singing Baronox, you're probably doing a million things that evening. You know, you have to do a million things really well. So that's an awful lot of things to think about. And it's your brain has to relax, your body has to relax, your throat has to relax, obviously, and get in shape to be ready to do the next performance really well.
And do you still think, I mean, Baronox, you've done it many times, but this is just an example. You still think before the performance about what you have to do, or this is so internally in there that it goes naturally? Not all necessarily the singing, but everything.
I remember this is a good thing about the dress rehearsal of the first time I did Baron Ox. I don't know if anyone knows this opera, Rosenkavalier. It's, you know, it's a very long, very difficult opera. And you basically have to, it's three acts for Ox, and it's basically like you're playing a concerto each act, basically. And I remember the dress rehearsal in Chicago when I did it for the first time. I literally, my brain just switched off for like 2 days, and I just sat in bed and I did nothing. I've never experienced it in my life before because I'd worked so hard to learn it and to get it into my system. And,
I remember those times.
So yeah, so I remember the first time I ever got Act One really right was about the sixth performance of that run in Chicago, and then you know. It is very internalized now, but at the same time you have to think, and you're never quite sure how it goes, and you have to have a nice conductor to do with it and lovely colleagues to do it with.
And how do you overcome, because you said by the sixth time, how do you overcome the first five times where you're presumably not necessarily happy with yourself?
No, you're still happy with this. Just getting it mostly right is quite good.
Wonderful. I like this approach. this is the best.
We just have to survive, don't you, these things? And then, you know, I'm naughty to say this, but I was going to do it at the Royal Opera House, Baron Ox, and I wanted to go and do it somewhere else first so I could get it into my body, into my system a bit before I went and did it at the Royal Opera House in 2017 with René Fleming and Andrews Nelsons. And you know, it was the greatest thing I will do in my life is to sing that role at that opera house, you know, that has been my home for 20 years, you know, and that was kind of like the highlight of my life, wasn't it?
If something goes wrong during a performance, whether it's a memory lapse or a technical issue, how do you recover and maintain your composure?
Yeah, you, first of all, you have to go into something with the attitude that nothing will go wrong. You have to have, and that was the greatest advice I ever heard. Someone, when I was a young artist at the Royal Opera House, we had a question and answer session with this lovely opera director, John Copley, and someone said, what do we do if we go wrong? And he said, well, first of all, you have to go into every situation knowing that things won't go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you have the attitude already that things could not be 100% perfect, then you're not going to strive towards that perfection and to get everything absolutely right. So one should always strive to get everything completely correct and to do our job as well as we possibly can. So then obviously things do go wrong because it's live performance and people forget things or they do things or they're put off by something, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the thing is just to stay calm and just to get back on track. That's the thing. It's all about staying on track somehow. These performances, and sadly or happily, 99% of people in the audience won't notice things different. You know, if you sing a note wrong or the wrong rhythm or blah blah blah. But you know, we're not doing these performances for the 99%. We're doing it for the 1% of people that really know. We're doing these performances for the people that really understand this music and really get it, knowing that the other 99% of people will understand, even if they don't have the expertise to understand, they'll at least get the fact that there's something brilliant happening. You know, that's how I see it. But we have to do, you know, if you're singing German in an English opera house, you have to get your German right for the 1% of people that are going to know it's not right. And if you're doing very difficult music, you have to do it for the 1% of people that know exactly what those notes are and what they're supposed to be. Mm. You know, we have to strive for that, I really do believe. And then, you know, that was the whole principle with Glyndebourne, is that the Christie family started this opera house and they wanted opera to be at its very, very best because they knew that every single person that walked into that opera house could understand the quality of something when it's a world-class thing being presented to them. People understand that. And it's so important that we strive for that and that we don't degenerate our performances towards anything less than that.
Is it like after premiere or after a couple of performances, do you have like a feedback with the director and discuss what went good and what went wrong and what needs to be changed?
No, not normally. Normally after the first night, the director goes. So then there's assistant directors there just wanting us to stand in the right place and do what we're supposed to do. But there's no, I mean, sometimes we did one thing at Glyndebourne again where Fiona Shaw, the famous actress from Harry Potter, everyone knows Fiona Shaw, she was directing us and she was there every night in every performance and she was giving us feedback and wanting us to do different things. And it was actually a lovely thing to have because it's lovely when you have a lovely collegial director that wants to just help you all perform as it's your absolute best. At the moment, I have a feeling that the importance of the director's vision is more important than actually putting on a great performance. I think that the whole idea of people in a room together is we want to do a great performance together. And it seems to me right now, the opera world is allowing directors to come in and do these fancy spectacular shows, and that's the most important thing, is these fancy spectacular shows, where actually these shows should be there to exist to give everyone in the room the chance to perform to their absolute best. And I worry slightly that element of performance is going away. You know, for instance, I've done operas at certain times where directors haven't cared about singers and what singers are able to do and what makes us happy and what makes us do our best job. That's what a great director should do, not just put on a fantastic snazzy show. It's actually about making the people up there on stage feel as comfortable as they can and be able to do their job in the best possible way and the way that they want to do and that they can contribute to the whole process. And I feel at the moment that the pendulum has swung too far towards the hand of the director, and it's a little bit too much in certain places about what the show looks like. Actually, the show looks like what it is, and the show should look as it does to help the performances be as great as they can be. It's a tricky thing, opera, you know, because you have all these different elements. You know, it used to be the age of the conductor, where whatever the conductor did was going, everyone cared about what the conductor did. Then it was like the age of the singer, and the singers kind of did whatever they wanted. Maybe the age of the singer was first, actually. And now it's become definitely very much the age of the director. And I don't know, I feel there's too much importance given to how something looks rather than how something is.
Mm-hmm. And how do you deal with something like, come back to Baron Ox, you've done it many times with different directors.
Yeah.
How do you deal with visions where presumably you don't necessarily like them? How do you adapt to these?
Yeah, I mean, ideally you would like these situations, and you would be with someone that's good enough to explain their vision. You know, I've done Baron Ox in very different ways. I've done it in a very... The first time I did it was a very traditional Viennese setting. It was completely, you know, as they would have done it in 1950, say. And then the next time with Robert Carson at the Royal Opera House, and he had a very different way of doing it. And then I did a very strange production somewhere else where nothing really made sense. And it was sort of all just about pictures and visions because the director didn't really know what the opera was about. And then I did it with Christoph Waltz, you know, the famous Austrian actor. We did it, and he did it incredibly seriously. He took all the comedy out of it, and he wanted to present this very dark Vienna where all this awful stuff happens underneath the fluff of the waltzes and the Prater and all this stuff, blah, blah, blah. And that was unbelievably interesting to do. I don't know how interesting it was for the audience, but to be with someone like Christoph Waltz, who thought this through so thoroughly and is such a brilliant person, you know, it was really quite remarkable to work with him. It was an incredibly valuable lesson for me to do that with him. And then the last time I did it was a very, you know, I had this ridiculous ginger wig and ginger chops, and there's nothing you can do but be ridiculous the whole time. So it's amazing how one piece can be done in such different ways, and hopefully you understand a piece from its center enough to be able to adapt yourself to what these people want. You know, you're always trying to make sense of what these people want and trying to do your own performance inside of their vision is kind of the idea. And, you know, the fact that you can have a piece and do it in five so completely different ways is just sort of, is credit to Hofmannsthal and Strauss, really, isn't it? And what that piece can offer.
Mm-hmm. The opera world, and not only the opera world, but
I'm going to have a chocolate biscuit, Alex. May I?
It's known for its fierce competition. How do you handle the pressure? I don't know. Is there any competition between singers? And what advice would you give to emerging young singers in dealing with this aspect?
So being a bass is very different from being a soprano. I mean, I do lots of things with young singers, and when people apply for the courses that I do, it's kind of like 92% are women and 8% are men. And then if you think in the men, there's bass baritones, there's basses, there's baritones, there's tenors, there's countertenors. So there's as much need for low male voices as there is for high female voices, and yet there's very many fewer of us doing it. So therefore, the pressure is a lot less on us in getting work and sustaining work. You know, I mean, I had someone write to me yesterday saying, you know, I'm a soprano and everything's really well on stage, I'm getting good reviews, but yet nothing's happening with my career. I mean, being a soprano is so hard, and you know, you think there's so fewer opportunities for sopranos, and you know, and 100 times more people, you know, for every one bass there's 100 sopranos out there trying to get work. So for us, it's a much easier, comfortable thing. You know, if you do your job well, you're going to get hired back and do stuff, hopefully. So I'd suggest to all sopranos and altos out there, just go and become basses, and then it becomes so much easier. I do a lot with young singers, and, you know, it's not just teaching them, it's sort of really making them ready to to be seeing as it can go out and have careers, which is all also about life pressure and stuff as well, isn't it, I guess. But yeah, I mean, it's a really tough industry. I mean, in Germany, every city has an opera house. There's 87 opera houses funded by this government or something. So if you were to go to Germany and start a career there, it's a much easier process than in the UK, say, where there are three full-time opera companies, two of which are in jeopardy right now. Mm-hmm. And then there's like seven or eight really fantastic summer festivals. But it means that the opera scene in the UK is wonderful for 6 weeks a year. You know, for May, for June and the middle of July, it's brilliant for singers in Britain. Yeah. And the rest of the year, it's really tough. No, but then if it's your vocation, it's something you feel you have to do and you have to, you know, like Nadia, but she said, you know, unless you have nothing else to do in the world, then you shouldn't become a musician, you know. If it absolutely is your vocation, that biscuit got me, and it is what you have to do, then strive to do it. And, you know, and you will find opportunities to do it on what, maybe it's a different course than what you dreamed of doing. And not, you know, not everyone can go and stand on the Met stage and sing Gilda. But, you know, there's still an awful lot of work out there you can do and be a concert singer, sing songs. You know, Alex, we know how that is, how lovely it is to sing this
absolutely
amazing music, especially by Mr. Schubert. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to do it, find out what you need to do to get to that level, to sustain that level, the people you need to meet, the opportunities you need to give yourself to get to those places. And then when you're given these opportunities, do them as well as you can and then continue to do things as well as you can. That's mm-hmm. basically, it sounds easy to do, but
maybe this is the good moment to talk about your newest project.
Well, thank you, Alex, for that. I'll have another bite of my biscuit. Yeah, so I've been given an opportunity. There's a town in England, people might know Folkestone in Kent, which is where the Eurostar goes into the ground. So if you're coming over from Paris or Brussels or something on the train, that's where you see England for the first time. And Folkestone somehow over the last 10, 15, 20 years has become, first of all, it was very much an arts town. They have a big arts festival every 3 years. And there are a lot of artists that have moved down there. And now a new train line has come in from London. And now a lot of musicians and people are moving down there. And it's now become a fantastic music town. And there's an amazing new music scene. There's a guy called John Woolrich, who's a very fantastic composer. And he brings world-class people down there very often to do events in Folkestone. The Saucony String Quartet have a festival and they have residencies there and they do a lot of stuff there. So there's an awful lot of really world-class music going on. And I've been invited to start a series of song and singing projects down there. So there was a composer called Tosti, who was quite famous. He wrote lots of songs. And he came over in the end of the 19th century to become Queen Victoria's singing teacher, as mm-hmm. it happens. And then he stayed in London and he became head of the Royal Academy of Music. And he had his summer house in Folkestone in this very beautiful building by the sea, which has these lovely grand rooms. It's called The Grand. So there's lots of events going on there. And so we're going to be based in The Grand. And there's also a lovely church where we're going to do concerts as well.
This gives me a lot of vibes of Matthew Rose and Friends.
Oh, like we did. I did a festival, everyone, in Alfriston in Sussex exactly. for Alexandra Solosia.
Yeah, they did it for me.
It was for Alex a long time ago, and I wish that carried on, but I unfortunately got a bit too busy. But yeah, so we're going to do a singing bursary in April. There's a lovely singer called Benjamin Luxon who died a few months ago, and he and his wife Sheila were very instrumental towards me and to many people in starting their careers. And we're going to start a bursary in their honour, which is going to happen at the end of April. And then in honour of Mr. Tosti, we're going to have a two-week academy, the Tosti International Singing Academy. And I've put together, yes, I'm so honoured what we put together. I know I've got absolutely world-class people. You know, the singers are going to come and do concerts with people like Malcolm Martineau, Julius Drake, Anna Tilbrook, and a friend of mine, Bénédicte Jourdois, who's at the Juilliard School, and she works at the Met, and she's just a wonderful pianist. We're going to do some Winterizers in New York in December. So they'll do concerts with them, and then I have masterclasses with Thomas Allen and Felicity Lott and John Tomlinson coming.
Amazing.
They're going to work with Louisa Muller, who's a world-class stage director, and her husband, Eric Malaya, who is now head of the National Opera Studio in London. And they're going to do opera scenes with the singers. And then there's a couple of singing teachers, me being one of them, the other being a wonderful mezzo-soprano from Canada, Michel Lozier. So they have singing classes with us every day. And then also I have a whole lot of people coming in to do coachings with them. So it's a very much a very
amazing
world-class thing.
How did you put all this together?
How did I put this together? I was in Santa Fe Opera for 2 months in the summer, and I had an awful lot of spare time on my hands. And I'd wake up every morning and just I just thought, let's just put together the best thing that's possible. Why not? And just ask all these people, and all they can do is say no. So I asked all these people, and most of them said yes. Only one said no, which I was a bit disappointed about. but he was on holiday. He's allowed. Which is Tony Papano. I was dreaming of Tony Papano coming, but he thought about it, and then he's decided to go to Italy instead, which is much more sensible.
I can understand.
But I think, you know, we're going to give them, and then also bring in agents and people, casting people from London. You know, it's going to be a really world-class thing that's going to give, hopefully, people 2 weeks to really take their singing game to the next level. And I want to have a group of really wonderful conservatoire singers, and also not even fledgling opera singers, just opera singers. You know, if somebody wants to come because they just want to have a couple of weeks with these people, and they're already out there working, then I'd be so happy for these people to
put. I'll put it in the description.
That's very kind. Thank you. And then also I'm going to do a 3-day song festival as well with some really world-class singers and pianists. So that's going to be the Folkestone International Song Festival.
That's amazing.
Which is happening 5th to the 7th of September next year. And yeah, I've got 8 singers and 3 pianists. And we're going to do a series of concerts all together. So it's not just one person doing a recital. You're going to have 8 singers through 4 concerts over the weekend. Plus, we're going to do a couple of events. So Graham Johnson, the wonderful academic and pianist and man who's done more for song probably than anyone that's ever lived, is going to come and do a 2-hour talk about his life with Schubert. And then we're going to have a Schubert day. On the last day, it's going to be a Schubert day, and do a Schubertiade. And we're going to do lots of part songs and things. It's just going to be a lovely thing, and I've got some really amazing colleagues and friends coming to do that, and that's, you know, the cherry on the cake. What I wanted to do was to have a place where people can understand the whole range of what it takes to become to be a singer. So you have from the very young people doing the bursaries through to very world-class singers, you know, and just have the range of this for people to understand what singing is all about, and to really get to love singing in a very different way.
That's amazing.
And we're hopefully going to have choirs. They've got a big event for a large children's choir next year, and I want to do more and more stuff with people in the community as well, so they can get up and do some singing themselves. So, you know, the whole idea is to bring singing to everyone in Folkestone and East Kent is the idea.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see how it takes flight. But I'm incredibly excited to put it all together.
You want to give it back.
We have to give it back, don't we, Alex? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Especially now. I mean, it's such a dangerous time for our industry right now, and we can't become complacent at all. And I don't think we should dumb anything down either. You know, we have to give people great, great things, and they have to harness onto these great, great things. You know, not just dumb down things and hope people come to see things because it's, you know, it might appeal to them. No, give them what this stuff is, which is really brilliant, brilliant, amazing music, and unbelievably talented people. Passionate, talented, moving people, and you know, I have a feeling that that's going to bring people to music like it should be brought to them. Mm-hmm. Is my opinion.
Well, with such a demanding profession, how do you balance personal life and career, and what has been key to sustaining long-term success in this
wine.
Big world?
Wine. And golf. So I play golf a lot. That's my thing. I like to play golf, Alex. That's basically all I want to do. So yeah, even now, you know, we're working in Munich and we have days off, and so I'm playing one of the giants. There's two brothers that are giants, so the two of us go off and play golf when we're not required to be at rehearsals. It's quite sweet, really. Two big blokes walking down the fairways of Munich's finest golf courses. You know, and it's you know, I love this job. You know, you get to go to all these places. You know, I feel at home in Vienna. I feel at home in New York. I feel at home wherever, you know, Berlin. You know, I go to all these cities very often and have so many wonderful friends and colleagues there and just feel so at home here. You know, I've not been to Vienna for 4 years, and yet it feels like this is where I'm supposed to be. You know, it's nuts. And I go to Edinburgh and feel the same. And I go to New York and feel the same. And
but
I go to Amsterdam and feel the same.
Such a positive.
Well, it's lovely. What an amazing thing. You know, in doing operas, you have an awful lot of time to be in these places. It's an amazing thing. And you meet these amazing people. And, you know, it's a pretty wonderful life, actually, apart from the whole learning the music thing.
But how do you deal with, I mean, you said you had 7 weeks of rehearsal, so you're always for a long time away from something else.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Or it's different now because I have nothing else to really be at home with. But, you know, it's sustaining relationships when you're away from home for, you know, I used to be away from home 10 months of the year.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, just sustaining anything when you're away for all that time makes it very hard. And, you know, no, and maybe I failed miserably in some things and succeeded in other things. And, you know, it's just, it makes life much harder than, you know, life is already hard as it is, and it makes life 100 times harder, and you cope with some things and you don't cope with other things, and it's just coping, isn't it? And hopefully not having too many regrets, I guess.
Are there any particular roles that have deeply influenced you or that you dream of performing?
I dream of performing. So Midsummer Night's Dream by Benjamin Britten was kind of the opera that took me to every great opera house in the world, including the opera house in Vienna. Although I was booked to do Midsummer Night's Dream in 2020 here in Vienna, and it was, you know, this was the place I saw my first ever opera, and I, you know, Vienna means more to me musically than anywhere when you think of what was written here and what was done here and how it's done here. And the only thing I did at the opera house was to test positive for COVID. But then 10 days later, the whole thing was cancelled anyway, so it doesn't matter. But bottom in Midsummer's Dream, I did it at Glyndebourne when I was very young. They were incredibly kind to me, as Glyndebourne have been to so many people over the years, to give people that probably were a big risk because they hadn't done much before. Glyndebourne bring young singers in to do things on a very high level, and they very kindly and generously and wonderfully gave me the chance to do possibly Midsummer Night's Dream, and then I've sort of done it in every major opera house in the world, and that opera took me everywhere in a very lovely way, and it showed me off to my very best. So, you know, without that, I wouldn't be doing Baron Ox in these places, I'm sure. What operas do I dream of doing? There's only one role, really. I mean, I would like to. I had one performance of King Philip in Don Carlos, which that's one of my top three operas, Don Carlos. And King Philip is just an amazing role to do. And I did one performance at the Met when I was understudying and didn't think I'd have a chance to go on at all. But I went to the theatre to do another role in the opera, and then an hour later I was on stage singing Philip. So, which I just found the video the other day, which is interesting. It wasn't terrible. I thought it was terrible. So I'd like to have another go at King Philip, especially in French. The year after next in Italian, but I'd love to do it in French again. And then the one role I really want to do that I've not done is Guernamance in Parsifal. I think Parsifal is just a remarkable opera, and Guernamance is just a beautiful role to sing, and that's the one thing I need to do, and then I can just go off and play golf and drink wine and organise stuff. I like organising things.
How do you connect with your audience in such large-scale productions where the physical distance between the stage and the audience can be so significant? Is there something you really feel, or there's...
Yeah, I mean, and it's, you know, it is so much, you know, being in these smaller opera houses in Europe. You know, the last couple of weeks I've been going to small towns and not smaller cities in Germany and seeing operas, and just being in these kind of very intimate settings and having people so close and so intimately connected to the audience, it just is kind of wonderful. You go to America and these, you know, the Met is, you know, when you sit at the top of the back of the Met, you don't see or hear very much at all. You just have to trust that what you're doing is big enough and meaningful enough that people are going to get things. I kind of always imagine someone sitting in the sixth row, and what are they hearing and seeing? And I have to kind of feed that person what I'm doing. If I do that, then hopefully everyone in the auditorium can see and hear what I'm doing. Now, a lot of stage directors nowadays don't want people looking out to the audience and singing. They want the fourth wall taken out, which I think is a mistake. And it's, you know, I think opera has to be, to really get opera and opera singers, you have to be able to see their faces and really hear their voices to their full. So if you're singing sideways and stuff all the time, you're going to get no enjoyment out of opera. I totally believe that, I'm sorry to say. Sorry, all you directors out there that want to have inverted commas reality going on. But, you know, opera is there because you want to see and hear people, and you want to be moved by people's performances, and I can only do that if you can totally see them and totally hear them. So I try and give people in the audience what I know I would want to see and hear when I go and see operas.
Mm. And my last question.
Oh, we're there already.
You've achieved so much. You've done
it's
so
amazing.
Much.
What, today? We're talking really quickly over my biscuit.
How is there something you still dream of achieving or dream of doing professionally?
No, I really want to, my thing now is really giving back both to the next generations of singers and musicians, music, not just singers, musicians too, and also to audiences, and really, you know, to really bring something to audiences that's going to make them want to come back, not because they're wowed by something that is not the opera, but by what the opera is and what the people on stage are doing. In all concerts, you know, I really believe it. I love singing songs and I love doing concerts, and I love doing concerts with orchestra as well. But, you know, I worry about our industry right now. We're in a real moment of crisis, actually, and I don't know if people are aware as much as they should be of how in crisis we are, and we have to do something so that the future is just as bright as it possibly can be, you know. So I want to help the next generation of singers be as wonderful as they can be and give to audiences what they need to do. That's what makes me more excited than anything to do, you know. I mean, I still enjoy singing, and it's still a thrill to sing, and it's still a thrill to do these things, but the other stuff's more important, I think.
So for all singers who have listened to this, when can they apply for Folkestone?
Hopefully soon. I need to just work out the whole application process, but yeah, thank you so much
so
for plugging that, Alex.
Space.
And we'll have some T-shirts made as well, so we'll get Alex a Folkestone on song T-shirt. yeah, it's going to be, it's online. Have you got in the link below? Is there going to be a...
Yes.
Okay, thank you for that. And then hopefully we'll have everything up and ready soon for people to apply.
So go.
I'm also going to do a course in Italy as well, in Spoleto in Italy as
well,
for 10
that.
Days
yes,
in June.
Yes, we've been doing
10th
this
to
for a 20th.
No, this is another one, a new one. Because you can't do enough of these things. You can't do enough of these things. So there we go.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Matthew. I appreciate
thank you,
it so
and
much.
And for breakfast,
and
a delicious coffee in my Rakes Progress mug from Glyndebourne. That was a lovely time.
Absolutely.
We were, Alex and I and her husband, Sebastian, were all in Glyndebourne at that time. So
happy
they were
memories.
Very happy memories, yes, of dear Vladimir and Helen and John Cox and David Hockney.
Exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex.
Much love.
Thanks for listening. This was Alexandra Siloccia from Pianofortissimo. Don't forget to subscribe, share with fellow music enthusiasts, follow us on your favorite social media, and most importantly, worry less and let the music flow.